Pacific Northwest School of the Prophets. Brother Jim Cowie is our study leader on the theme, The Kingdom of God versus the Kingdom of Men. Yahweh will destroy Nimrod. This is session 3, entitled, Nimrod, the Mighty Hunter, Confronting Yahweh. Brother Jim, please.
Well, good morning, brethren. When I woke up this morning in this wonderful little place in the wilderness, with its stark beauty, its silence, I said to myself, this is like a once-in-a-decades-long experience, isn't it? To be able to get away from the world, secrete ourselves away from all the things, most of the things that belong to this world, and just to focus our minds upon the things of the Spirit. There's very few experiences in life like that. And so I'm excited about the weekend together, and I've got another one of these, God willing, in 2 weeks' time down in California. So I'm going to get a double dose. But I think we should all give thanks to our God, as has been done already in the prayers that have been offered for this opportunity. And let's make the most of it together over the course of this next couple of days. It's a wonderful blessing indeed. Well, this morning we're going to start our process of looking more deeply at Yahweh's great enemy, Nimrod. And we're going to see just how much of an enemy he is and why he's an enemy. And we're going to start with the relatively simple and move to the less well-known. And basically that's going to be our approach in this study anyway. We're going to be looking at things that are reasonably well known, except perhaps of some of the elements of Joshua last night, but things that are reasonably well known and move to the more complex, things that are not so well known, but perfectly consistent, as David mentioned in his prayer, perfectly consistent with what we know to be true. And so, you know, the duty of someone in my position, if you're in that position, your duty is to do what Christ said you should do. You should bring out from the divine storehouse things old and new. Now the things new are not new in the sense that they're not there, they are there. They're things in the Word of God that you haven't seen before. Others may have seen them, you haven't seen them before. So to you they're new, but they are perfectly consistent and harmonious with what you know to be true. It's very, very important to understand that that's what's meant by the new there. It's not some new thing from left field that doesn't sit with what you know to be right. It's got to be harmonious. And I think you're going to see that as we proceed in our studies. So let's have a look at this man. Now there's going to be some history, a little bit of history, but hopefully easily grasped. So I'm going to do a lot of quotations in this first session and then look more at the scripture in the second session this morning. But once or twice we're going to have a look at some passages. And Genesis 9 is going to be the first passage that I'm going to refer to. So you might like to have Genesis 9 open. Now many of you will be familiar with this chart that is on the screen. This has been around for a while. It's a very, very good chart actually. And it's the framework of Bible prophecy as our community has understood it for 160 odd years. It's been proven right, not only by personal study of thousands of brethren, but by history, of course, and by what's happening right now. It's been proven correct. Nebuchadnezzar's image, of course, is here, and we're familiar with that. It's sometimes called Daniel's image. I'll just make that point. It's not Daniel's image. This image is about the kingdom of men. Daniel wants nothing to do with this image. He wants to destroy it. He wants to be part of the stone power that strikes it on the feet. It's not Daniel's image. It's Nebuchadnezzar's image because it represents the kingdom of men. It represents what he stood for not what God stands for. And so here we've got Nebuchadnezzar's image, and of course we know that while that is all about history, the unfolding of four world empires over time, it's not what it's about. Nebuchadnezzar's image is there to speak about the latter days. Oh yes, it's true that there would be four world empires, but those four empires were to be brought together into one empire in the latter days, to be destroyed by Christ and the saints, the stone power which strikes the feet. I'm going to have a bit of a look at that. Now, that's old, isn't it? But there may be some new elements in this that we will pick up along the way in terms of Nebuchadnezzar's image. But you see all this stuff in the middle here. So you've got the image there in the latter days, right at the end of the chart, see? Well, here's your history. You had the Lion of Babylon, the Bear of Medo-Persia, the leopard and goat power of Greece, and then you've got, of course, the fourth beast, probably some kind of crocodile-type creature, the Roman Empire. But then this flows off into the apocalyptic symbols, to the symbols of Daniel, go to the apocalyptic symbols that we'll come to in due time in our studies. We're going to see this pattern, as the word was used, this pattern of divine prophetic foretelling of what's going to happen and what, of course, has already happened in the history of those empires. So that's the chart, and we're going to be referring to it on the odd occasion as we proceed through with our studies. But let's take this just a step further. Let's have a look at these empires. We're familiar with the Assyro-Babylonian Empire because it was, in fact, that. And we're going to see from Daniel 7 a bit later on, it went through two distinct phases. There was the Assyrian phase and there was the Babylonian phase. Well, who established the Assyro-Babylonian Empire? Nimrod. Goes right back to Nimrod, way back to the beginnings of the book of Genesis, as we're going to see. He was the founder of that empire. Now, in Daniel 7, and maybe I was misled you, let's have a look at Daniel 7 before we look at Genesis 9. We'll come back to that in due course. In Daniel chapter 7, we have, of course, the four beasts. Now, just on a very simple point, why is the kingdom of men represented in Daniel chapter 2 by the figure of a man, but in Daniel chapter 7 by the figures or symbols of beasts? Does anyone suggest why that would be the case? Yes, Chris?
Because God sees the kingdom. Man sees the kingdom of man, God sees the man.
Exactly. So man sees himself as big, you know, like an image, huge, terrible in its appearance. God sees men as beasts. So when you see in Daniel chapter 2, and we'll have a look a little later on in our studies at Daniel chapter 3, and we'll see how Nebuchadnezzar saw himself, because he made an image all of gold, remember? That's how man sees himself in all his glory. But when God looks at men and the nations of men, he sees them as wild beasts, and that's, of course, what they are. Now in Daniel 7 at verse 4, we read concerning the Assyro-Babylonian lion these words. The first was like a lion, and had eagle's wings, and I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth and made stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it. Okay, so what happened was that there were two distinct phases in this empire. There was the Assyrian phase, this is the winged phase, and of course this imagery, if you've been to the British Museum in London, you'll know that there's tons of this stuff there, of the winged lions. A wing, of course, in scripture is a symbol for the spreading of armies, that the control that you exercise by armies. Of course, the Assyrians were known for spreading their armies across that region and taking control, viciously taking control of that area. So they were ruthless. You've heard about the Assyrians, and Gog, of course, is likened to the Assyrians, isn't he? Gog's treatment of people, the people in the land of Israel and those who come to that land to fight him, is going to be even more vicious than what we've seen from ISIS. You know, the Assyrians used to smash the heads of babies against stone walls in the front of their mothers and then kill their mothers. So that's the kind of treatment they dealt out. So when Gog comes into the land, expect to see some horrible things from your perspective as a saint then. Expect to see some horrible things, because it's going to happen. Because Gog is the latter-day Assyrian, and his treatment of God's people will be no different in our time than it was in the past. So this is the Assyrian phase, a brutal, ruthless phase. But then we read that it's called, the wings are plucked, lifted up from the earth, have made a stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given. In other words, it became a little more humane in the Babylonian phase. A little more humane, okay? And that's why you've got this imagery which comes from the Ishtar Gate in Babylon. A lion just walking like a lion, hasn't got any wings. But it prefigures that fact that there would be this switch to a more humane approach to the nations that Babylon controlled. Not that they were treated all that nicely, by the way, anyway, but it was a little bit more humane. So here is the man who founded that empire. And we saw his name yesterday, and we looked at that. I won't go through this in any detail again, but we saw that this is the only known depiction of Nimrod that they've found, and that his name means the rebel, or we will rebel. And we're going to see that rebellion revealed in our studies, the first two studies today. Now, back in Genesis 10 and verse 8, we read that Cush begat Nimrod. Now, it's, of course, fascinating, even though I must point out that this phrase, Nimrod ben Cush, is not actually the exact Hebrew in Genesis 10 verse 8, so don't make that mistake. But in fact, it's true that Nimrod was the son, the ben of Cush. Just happens to have a numerical value of 666. Now, I don't think that's accidental. I think that's probably intended to be the case, and we're going to see this number 666 come out quite frequently. Nimrod, there's the numerical value. You're aware, of course, of gematria, the principle of gematria. Both in the Hebrew and the Greek, they are unique languages in the sense that they have a numerical value for each letter of the alphabet. Now, we don't have this in English. You know, A doesn't represent... You know, A is the first letter of the alphabet, it doesn't represent one, but A let does. So, you know, in the Hebrew and in the Greek, each letter of the alphabet has a numerical value. So you can work out the numerical value of every word, every phrase, every sentence in the Bible, in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. And Nimrod, here's the numerical value. This is the letters of his name, M-R-R-D. There's no vowels, and it adds up to 294. Ben, there it is, 52. And there's Cush, 320. Happens to be 666. So it gives you a little bit of an idea where that's heading, eh? Because you can see from that very plainly that Nimrod is the founder of the papacy. And the number of the papacy is 666, as we know from Revelation 13, verse 18. Here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. It's the number of a man. And Nimrod founded what? The kingdom of men. So it goes right back to him. Now, we looked at Cush last night. I'm not going to go through that in any more detail, but I need to put that up again, because remember the principle of Micah 6 verse 16, for the statutes of Omri are kept, and all the works of the house of Ahab. So Cush was the great prophet of Babylonianism. He was the man who put together the catechism, the belief system. He was the man who made the plans, but it was Nimrod who carried them into effect. And he brought about reality on the ground. Just like it was in the case of Omri, who was the statute maker. He was a pretty busy man, Omri, by the way. He bought the hill of Shemer and built the city of Samaria, and he reigned for 12 years. You know, he was a pretty busy man, but he was busier as a founder of ideas. He was an ideologue, the man who put the ideology together. And it was Ahab that promoted it and brought it into existence, especially in regard to bringing in Baal worship into Israel. So there's your principle that we saw last evening. Now, let's have a look at Genesis chapter 10 and verse 9. So back in Genesis 10, we read in verse 8 that Cush begat Nimrod. I'll get there. Verse 8, Cush begat Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before Yahweh. Wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before Yahweh. Now, I think most of you are aware that when you read things like that, where there's a duplication, there's clearly an emphasis, God wants you to sit up and take notice. He's telling you, I want you to take notice. There's something very important about this man. And so we need to ascertain what that is in this statement that is made here in both verse 8 and verse 9, that he began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before Yahweh. Now this word before is pani. It means in front of or before it or to the front of, in the presence of, in the face of, or at the face or front of. That's the meaning given in the Hebrew lexicons for this word pani. And we're familiar with that, most of us. So what does it mean? Does it mean that he was just there in the vision of God, that God saw him? Or does it mean something more? Well, it means something more. And we're going to see what that means. Keel and Dalish, in their commentary on this section, say, in the face of Yahweh, which is how you would render that literally, can only mean in defiance of Yahweh, as Josephus and the Targums understand it. So this is not about someone being in the presence of God. Like, I'm out here, you know, and you're in my presence. You're in front of me, okay? I don't mean that. This is talking about Nimrod being in the face of Yahweh. We use that phrase, don't we? People get in your face. In other words, they oppose you. They come at you. Well, that's what this is about. Nimrod was a challenger of Yahweh's authority. In fact, he usurps God's authority. He usurps his power. And he becomes, as a result, the first God king upon the earth. The first man worshipped as a god. And he establishes the kingdom of men on the basis of that fact. So let's have a bit of a closer look at what the historical records say. Now here's the Targum of Jonathan. Now I'm not terribly familiar with the Targums of the old Jewish writings, but I've read a few of them. And people have picked the eyes out of them. And here are some quotes from various records, including Josephus. The Targum of Jonathan says, from the foundation of the world, none was ever found like Nimrod, powerful in hunting and in rebellions against the Lord. Well, it just gives you that idea of Nimrod being an opponent. Now, this is what I want you to be in Genesis chapter 9. In Genesis 9, we read this in verse 1. And God blessed Noah and his sons and said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. This is when they've just come out of the ark. And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every fowl of the air, upon all that moveth upon the earth and upon all the fishes of the sea. Into your hand are they delivered. Every moving thing that liveth shall be meat or food for you, even as the green herb have I given you all things. Now, what's that saying, do you think? Well, think about this. For 12 months, Noah had in the ark all the animals, including the wild beasts. Lions and tigers and leopards and jaguars and you name it. And he could feed them. He and his family could feed them. Not what they fed them. Who knows what they fed them, where they get the meat from anyway. They fed them, but they were not devoured by them. So you see, in the ark, Noah and his family had control over the animal. God gave them control over the wild beasts. When they came out of the ark and the animals spread out to, you know, multiply, God says, you had control in the ark. I'm going to continue that control. You're going to have that control over these animals. They're going to fear you. Not the other way around, they're going to fear you. But, there's always a but, isn't there? That control was only given while there was no rebellion against him, while there was no sin dominant in their lives. When sin returned, and of course it returns at the end of Genesis 9, doesn't it? When you've got Ham and Canaan doing their bit, when Noah makes his mistake, gets drunk and is naked, and I won't go into the details of that, but it's pretty awful. That's when sin arose back. Guess what God did in due course? Having given them control over the animals and having the animals fear humans only because sin had been eradicated from the earth. When sin returns, the wild beasts return to their savagery of men. And we know this is true. I'll ask you a question. We've just read it in our readings in 2 Kings chapter 17. When the Assyrians took the last 28,000 people out of the land of Israel and took them off to various lands and replaced them with five nations who they brought from various parts of the then known world, and they became known ultimately as the Samaritans, what was their problem when they came into the land of Israel? Anyone know what their problem was? Yeah, the wild beasts, the lions, rose against them. Why? Well, they concluded it was because they didn't know the God of the land. So what was their answer? Yeah, so they brought a prophet of Jeroboam in, which doesn't really sound like a great way to go to me, but anyway, they brought a prophet of Jeroboam in, a priest of Jeroboam, I should say, and he taught them the God of the land. I'm not sure he knew much about the God of the land, but anyway, at least there was an acknowledgement of Yahweh. And so the wild beasts were tamed to some degree. The problem was resolved. Okay, got the idea of that? So where there's ignorance and rebellion and sin against God, he causes the wild beast to rise up again. Even a man, the man of God from Judah, remember him? He came with a message, but he didn't obey. What happened to him? A lion killed him. So you can go through. What about the man in 2 Chronicles 20, where you have the record of Ahab defeating the Syrians, and then he releases Ben-Hadad and makes him a friend, and etc. What happens to the man that the son of the prophet smites or wants to be smitten by? He doesn't do it. A lion rose against him. You can go through the scripture. You'll find that that's what happens. So what happened here in Genesis 9 was that God ultimately had to take away that control and the wild animals rose against them. But there was a man who had an answer. And his name was Nimrod. He was a mighty hunter in the face of Yahweh. In other words, he said to his people, look, the wild animals have risen against us, but don't worry about that. I'm going to go out and hunt them, and I'll do more than that, and we're going to see what he did. I'm going to protect you from these wild animals. And he did that. And so the people looked at him and said, well, that's what God did for Noah and his family. He protected them, he gave them control, but you know, that was taken away, but now this man has restored the control. He must be God. So they began to worship Nimrod as God. Do you know, it's a historical fact, that the Assyrian kings got and maintained their power by one single means. They had to be mighty hunters. And that's why when you go to the British Museum, for example, and this is what they call a frieze. It's like wallpaper, but it's in stone. If you go to the Assyrian section in the British Museum in London, you will see the walls are covered with these friezes that have been taken from the palaces of Nineveh and Nimrod way back in the 1800s by Layard and others and in the early 1900s. They brought these back and put them in the museums. You find them in the Museum of Istanbul, for example. You find the Ishtar Gate in the Museum of Berlin. So there's evidence there taken from these ancient cities. And nearly everyone, I was amazed, nearly every single depiction of Assyrian kings has them killing lions. And you see all these, I mean this lion's got a couple of arrows in him. There are others where there are lions sort of, you know, with their legs up in the air and stuck full of arrows. There are friezes where the Assyrian king is off the chariot and he's fighting a lion with a sword. See, so but the idea of that is that for them to become the king, they had to be a mighty hunter, because that's the pattern that was set by Nimrod. He challenged the authority of Yahweh. He usurped the authority of Yahweh over the wild animals. He quelled them. He got rid of the danger, so they worshipped him. They made him their God king. And that's how his successors continued to maintain their power. Got the idea of that? Is that reasonably plain? Well, it's very important to understand that, because this is how he does become a god. Now I want to take you to what's called the Gilgamesh Epic. Anybody ever heard of that before? Gilgamesh Epic. This here is the 11th tablet of a series of tablets that were found in the ruins of these ancient Assyrian cities, which they have, of course, been able to decipher in more recent times. And this Gilgamesh legend is actually all about Nimrod. And we ask the question here, is Gilgamesh actually Nimrod? Well, we want to demonstrate that, in fact, it was. Gilgamesh, in this epic, you know, a bit like a story that's written, like a legendary story that's written in books that you can read today. It's that kind of thing. But it goes way, way back to the times of Nimrod. Gilgamesh was a vile, filthy man. His arrogance, ruthlessness and depravity were a subject of grave concern for the citizens of Uruk. Now, Uruk, in the epic, is Erech, which you'll find was one of the cities of Nimrod in Genesis 10, verse 10. And we'll come back to that in a moment, because that, in fact, was the city of Enoch rebuilt. It was Cain's city rebuilt. We'll come to that a little later on. They sought to distract his mind from the warrior's daughter and the nobleman's spouse, whom it appears he would not leave in peace. Now, I don't know what you've observed about human rulers, even in modern times. But when they fail, it's either, you know, that they want to put their hands on money, but quite often it's in relation to women, isn't it? It's in relation to some kind of moral corruption that they collapse under the weight. And we know from our own history that that's a problem. So where you have corruption at the top, it's usually going to involve women. This guy, this Gilgamesh, would not leave women alone. You know, he was always out. And that's the history of the world. It's the history of the Bible, if you read it carefully. Dr. David P. Livingston, I don't think this is the guy that was in Africa, said, in the epic, the hero is a vile, filthy, perverted person. Yet he is presented as the greatest, strongest hero that ever lived. So that the one who sent the flood will not trouble them anymore, Gilgamesh sets out to kill the perpetrator. So Gilgamesh, allegedly Nimrod, challenges Yahweh. He's in the face of Yahweh. He says, we're not going to let you destroy us again by a flood. So what are we going to do? We're going to build a tower. That's what we're going to do. Now Josephus records in his Antiquities, he says this, he also said he would be revenged on God if he should have a mind to drown the world again, for that he would build a tower too high for the waters to be able to reach. Which, of course, is ludicrous, but that's what that was his plan. And that he would avenge himself on God for destroying their forefathers. So this is the kind of language that you find in this Gilgamesh epic. It clearly is about Nimrod. So he challenges Yahweh. This, again, is a similar quotation. In the epic, Gilgamesh says, if I fall, I will establish a name for myself. Notice that. I will establish a name for myself. Yes, let us make us a name. We'll come to that in our next session, God willing. Gilgamesh is fallen, they will say, in combat with terrible Huwawa. Now the Huwawa of the epic is the biblical Yahweh. So here is the man who's in the face of Yahweh. He's challenging his authority. He's wanting revenge for the flood. He's going to make sure that people worship him and not this God, this alleged God who sent the waters to destroy their forefathers. That's what this epic's about, okay? It's clearly about Nimrod. So, you know, we just read two verses in Genesis 10, but history shows there's a lot more behind that. And if you interpret those two verses in Genesis 10, verses 8 and 9 correctly, this is the story of what happened. This is why it says that he was in the face of Yahweh. He's God's great enemy, this man. Now Josephus again in the Antiquities says, now it was Nimrod who excited them to such an affront and contempt of God. He was the grandson of Ham, the son of Noah, a bold man and of great strength of hand. He persuaded them not to ascribe it to God, as if it were through his means they were happy, but to believe that it was their own courage which procured that happiness. He also gradually changed the government into tyranny, seeing no other way of turning men from the fear of God but to bring them into a constant dependence upon his own power. Can anybody see there a reflection of another system that we're very familiar with? What about the papal system? You know what the papal system does? The papal system works on the basis that it's going to put men in their fear, seeing no other way of turning men from the fear of God but to bring them into a constant dependence upon his own power. And there are centuries of history where the papacy has made sure that people don't read the Bible, have no access to the Bible, and if you do, they'll burn you at the stake. They make sure that you are dependent on them and their priesthood and not upon God. That's the policy that was adopted by Nimrod. It's the policy followed by the church today. Alfred Edersheim, now you're all familiar with the Christian Jew in the 1800s, Alfred Edersheim, who wrote many books. In his Bible History of the Old Testament, he said this: "Even Josephus, the ancient Jewish historian, regards Nimrod as the father of heathenism, the characteristic of which is to find strength and happiness in sin and not in God." Interesting, isn't it? "Its essential principle is to reject all that is not seen and to cling to that which is temporal." Now that wouldn't be human, would it? Of course, it's very human, isn't it? "Idolatry," he says, "is the religion of sight in opposition to that of faith. Instead of the unseen creator, man regarded that which was visible, the sun, the moon, the stars, as the cause and ruler of all." So that is what imbued the religion of Nimrod. It goes right back to the beginnings. And what we see today is simply a carryover of that approach. Now, we're getting towards the end of these quotations, but I think you can see that there's some interest in this, isn't there? It actually is telling us a lot about this man, which we're not told in fullness in the scriptures itself. We're meant to interpret Genesis 10, verses 8 and 9 this way. He goes on to say, "Or else he converted his heroes, real or imaginary, into gods. The worship of the heavens, the worship of nature, or the worship of man, such is heathenism and idolatry. The worst of it was that man gradually became conformed to his religion. He first imputed his own vices to his gods, and next imitated the vices of his gods." Which is what men do, don't they? Do you know that the world we live in today has been framed by movies? Hollywood is the centre of that, of course. It's been framed by movies. Are you conscious of the fact that the movies that are shown, and I don't see that much of it, I don't think you see much of it, but what I do see, the snippets here and there, you're conscious of the fact that they have a principle that they operate by, and that is that they want to be a step or two down the road from where society is today? So if you take, for example, the explosion surrounding homosexuality. How did that happen? Well, because you see, even before it became something that people pushed in society, the movies began to depict it. The movies, the soap operas on television, they were a step or two down the road. And they are promoting that, see? And when people catch up with them, when society catches up, they go another step down the road. Do you know that now in America, not only do they have gay marriage in some states, they're now pushing for multiple homosexual marriage. Not just two of the same sex, but three or four in the one marriage contract. It'll be on your television pretty soon, because they're pushing that wheelbarrow down the road. That's what happens in the world today. That's what happened in the past. So we've got man gradually becoming conformed to his religion, whatever that religion might be. And that was seen in that they first imputed their vices to his gods and next they imitated them. That was Nimrod and his company. Now in 1 Chronicles chapter 1 and verse 10 we read this: "And Cush begat Nimrod, he began to be mighty upon the earth. The Call D paraphrase of that passage says, Cush begat Nimrod, who began to prevail in wickedness, for he shed innocent blood and rebelled against Jehovah, as they put it, the hybrid name of Yahweh. So here we've got another little explanation of what was meant by in the face of Yahweh. He was to prevail in wickedness, shed innocent blood, and rebelled against God. You know, the shedding of innocent blood there is not about animals, is it? And this is the next phase of this session this morning. The next phase is that having been made a god in the eyes of his people by suppressing the wild beasts and protecting them from harm, from animals, guess what he next does? Next, he wants to take over the world. Next, he's going to use that violence and oppression against people. So the hunting of animals becomes now the hunting of people. It takes that next step. And this is what Keelan Dalis say in regard to that. Nimrod, the hunter of men. Nimrod was mighty in hunting, and that in opposition to Yahweh. He founded a powerful kingdom, and the founding of this kingdom is shown by the verb with consecutive to have been the consequence or result of his strength in hunting. Hence, if the expression a mighty hunter relates primarily to hunting in the literal sense, we must add to the literal meaning the figurative signification of a hunter of men, that is, a trapper of men, by stratagem and force. Nimrod, the hunter, became a tyrant, a powerful hunter of men. So this is the next stage of the development of this power. And the Jerusalem Targum says, he was powerful in hunting and in wickedness before the Lord. He was a hunter of the sons of men. And he said to them, depart from the judgment of the Lord and adhere to the judgment of Nimrod. I think I might have quoted things last night that sounded a bit like that. All law is in the repository of our breast. Remember that? The papacy above law. Yep, that's what he said. Depart from the judgment of the Lord and adhere to the judgment of Nimrod. Therefore it is said, as Nimrod is the strong one, strong in hunting and in wickedness before the Lord. Well, that's just about it for the quotations I want to make. I think it was necessary, brethren, to have a little bit of background of what history outside of the Bible actually says and what writers about this history have said. And I think you can see how important that is to understand the depth of the influence of this man Nimrod. And I don't think he gets enough airtime in our community. I know I'm accused of being the Nimrod man in Christadelphia, but I know that. But he doesn't get enough airtime, does he? And the whole point of this study is to demonstrate that Yahweh has a great enemy, and that enemy is Nimrod. And he's determined to destroy him. That's why we've titled this study, Yahweh Will Destroy Nimrod. And we're going to see, when we get to the apocalypse, that's exactly what he's going to do. You won't find the name Nimrod in the apocalypse, but he's all over the place there. All over the place. And we're going to see that the culmination of the three great covenants of the Bible is all about the destruction of Nimrod. So it's very, very important to understand it. So we go back and have a look at this picture. Now this is an artist's depiction of what Babylon might have looked like in the times of Nimrod and Semiramis. Who knows? One thing we do know is that they built a tower which didn't get completed. Now this tower appears to be complete to me. It's a ziggurat. But we read that the beginning of his kingdom was Babel and Erech and Akkad and Calneh in the land of Shinar. Question, when you read Shinar, who do you think of? Semiramis. All right? That's one of the equations you take away from this weekend. When you read Shinar, think Semiramis, the wife of Nimrod. And again, we'll emphasise that when we get to our next session or two. So, what about this city that he built? Well, this is a quotation from that gentleman that I mentioned last night, remember? Bryce Self, from the book Semiramis, Queen of Babylon. And this is what he says about Cain's city being rebuilt. He says, it was in Mesopotamia that the first cities were built after the flood. And it was Nimrod who built them. And the first of these was quite naturally named after the very first city built by man before the flood, Enoch. Now, whether it's exactly the same place, we don't know. What we do know is that it was given the same name. Cain built a city, remember? And he called it Enoch. Due to vagaries of linguistic permutation, this name has come down to us as Erech or Uruk in Sumeria. Now, don't confuse Sumeria with Samaria. Different, all right? Sumeria is the area of Babylon. It's the area around Euphrates and the Tigris. So here we've got this man suggesting, I think he's probably quite right, that when Nimrod builds his first city, he names it after the first city built by Cain. Now, that's very appropriate, isn't it? Because the building of cities was a challenge to God. It was a place where Cain sought refuge from those who might take vengeance for him killing his brother. It was about him defending himself, not about putting trust in Yahweh, who said to him, I'll protect you and I'll avenge you. He said, no, I'm not interested in that. Build his own city to protect himself. That's what Nimrod's about. Nimrod's about building cities to protect his people and himself from the wild beasts. That's what he's about. Well, he built mega cities. Now come back to Genesis chapter 10. Genesis 10 verses 10 through 12. And the beginning, the literal translations, like Young Literal says, the first part of his kingdom. The first part of his kingdom was Babel. Well, of course, Babel's where they built the tower. And Erech. So when he starts to extend that, he builds the city Erech, or Enoch, naming it after Cain's city. And Akkad and Calneh in the land of Shinar. That territory belonged to his wife, Semiramis. Then it says this, out of that land went forth Asher and builded Nineveh and the city Rehoboth and Calah and Rezin between Nineveh and Calah. The same is a great city. Now, I think some of you are aware that that's not a good translation. If you look at your margin, when it says in verse 11, out of that land went forth Asher, it says, he went out into Assyria. Now, Asher is another way of putting Assyria. And what this is telling us is that Nimrod, having built the first mega city with four cities, like four corner posts of a compound, decided that wasn't sufficient because he had people who served him in another place. So he built the first mega city in the area that we know as Babylon. But of course, he had people in Assyria. So he went to Assyria and he built another mega city with four cities that had like corner posts of a compound. Two great mega cities. Included these cities, Babel or Babylon, Erech, Akkad and Calneh, Nineveh, Rehoboth, Calah and Rezin. Now, let me ask you a question. When Jonah arrived at Nineveh, it says that Nineveh was a city of 3 days' journey. You know what that means? Anyone know what that means? Now, how far can you walk in a day at 4 miles an hour or thereabouts, 3 or 4 miles an hour? They say 20 miles. An army, 20 miles a day is enough on Shanks's pony. Okay? So if Nineveh is a city of 3 days' journey, Chris, what? It means on your feet. Yeah. So if Nineveh is a city of 3 days' journey, how far is that? Approximately 60 miles. Now, do you think that the city of Nineveh was 60 miles wide? Is there a city in the world today 60 miles wide? Well, in Queensland, we have housing, solid housing, basically, from the Gold Coast to Noosa, it's 100 miles. Okay, but, you know, it's not one city. It's a collection of communities. There isn't a city on earth today that's 60 miles wide. So this is not talking about a complex of houses that's 60 miles wide. This is talking about a compound. Now just take this screen as looking down. Let's just look down upon this area. Let's just say for argument's sake that Nineveh is down here in this corner. Well, these other cities that are mentioned, Rehoboth up there, Calah up there, and Rezin down there. On each of the corners, there's a city, like a corner post of a compound. So what do you do then? Well, you build a wall between each of those cities. So you keep out wild animals. Plenty of room for crops inside. No one's going to harm you. No lion's going to come and catch you in the field because there's a fence, there's a wall around it. It's like the Chinese built the wall to keep out their enemies, you know, the Great Wall. You build a wall to protect yourself from your enemies. That's what he did. He built these two huge compound mega cities to protect his people. No wonder they worshipped him as a god. They lived peaceful lives. They could do what they liked and wild animals wouldn't bother them. God was, you know, God was cancelled out. He could raise what he liked against them, but they couldn't get past the walls, so Nimrod protected them. So what do then? You worship him as a god king. It's the first human god, the god of the earth, the first king of a kingdom of men. Got it? That's what we're being told here in Genesis chapter 10. Very, very important. Well, what's God's answer? Now, we're going to deal with God's answer in our next study shortly, God willing. The earliest Babylonian kings bore the title Four Races. Now, I don't know where they got that from, but that's what they were called. Four Races. He had two mega cities, each with four towns. Okay? When God called Abram and developed from him Israel, the nation was marked by four. There were four mothers for the 12 tribes. There was a four-square encampment when Israel came out of Egypt, from Sinai onwards. There were four standards. There were four corners to the camp of Israel. I don't need to tell you that the city that comes down from God out of heaven is like the most holy place. It's a perfect cube. God has an answer for Nimrod. He can build mega cities to make himself a god in the eyes of his people. But Yahweh would start with one man called Abram, and when he's finished, he's going to have a perfect mega city. And guess what? You and I will be in it, protected from the great enemy that we've got, the nature we bear, the serpent who will be destroyed. But it's the serpent that's being manifested in Nimrod. So there we are. We're going to have a look, God willing, in a moment, at what happens at the Tower of Babel, the confusion of languages, and God's answer to that, both in the short term and the long term. Thank you, Robin.